Good morning. This is Morning Edition on Vermont Public Radio. I'm Mitch Wertlieb. Our guest today knows a thing or two about telling stories. The author of numerous works of fiction and essays, Salman Rushdie won the Booker Prize in 1981 for his novel Midnight's Children, and later that decade became something of a story himself when his novel The Satanic Verses drew outrage from some Muslims around the world and a call for his assassination issued in a fatwa by Iran's Ayatollah Khomeini. So it is also accurate to say that Salman Rushdie knows a thing or two about the power of stories. And one of those takes the reader on a journey to find out where stories come from. It chronicles an adventure to save tales, both new and ancient, from being poisoned into nothingness. Haroon and the Sea of Stories was published in 1990 and has been chosen by the Vermont Humanities Council as this year's Vermont Reads book to be read statewide by students throughout Vermont. And we are delighted to have Salman Rushdie in our VPR studios today to tell us more about Haroon and the Sea of Stories. Mr. Rushdie, it is a real pleasure to speak with you. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you. I'm really pleased. I'm really excited about this book being part of this wonderful project.
Well, you know, the book can be enjoyed by any reader of any age. It's not specifically for kids, but the hero of the book is Haroon, a 12-year-old boy. And there are fantastical creatures populated throughout the book that make it especially appealing, I think, for younger readers. What prompted you to write a novel that could be enjoyed by a younger audience?
I mean, well, quite simply, my son. I mean, my son who was at the time much. I mean, he's now 35, but when the book was written, he was like 10, 11 years old, and kept badgering me to write a book that he could read. And some of this began as stories that I would tell him, you know, as like bedtime stories. And of course, those were much, much simpler and briefer. But they contained the germ of this idea that there might be somewhere a magical sea where all the stories come from, you know, and that was elaborated into the book.
And I understand that getting this to the Vermont Reads Project happened because you met with someone that will be familiar to many Vermont readers, a literary person here in Vermont. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it was Major Jackson, and he and I had both been invited to a very nice little literary festival in Treasure Beach, Jamaica, I think called the Calabash Festival. It happens every 2 years. And last year we were both there, and he mentioned to me that the people here at the folks at Vermont Reads were considering this as a possible book. And if it were chosen, he said, would I be willing to come? And I said, yeah, it sounded like a great idea to me. And so I said, sure, if there's a way of, you know, getting a whole new generation of particularly young people, you know, to have a look at the book, I'd be very happy to come and take part in it. And then next thing I knew is they chose the book. So here I am.
Here you are in the middle of winter, too. You pick the best time to come. It's very, very cold out. Well, in the book, Haroon, his father, and a great supporting cast of magical creatures must travel to the Sea of Stories, as you mentioned, which is being slowly poisoned by a dark figure, literally a dark figure, Khatum Shud. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Mm-hmm.
The Sea of Stories is where all tales originate. And I wonder if you would read this passage to us that describes the Sea of Stories.
He looked into the water and saw that it was made up of 1,000, 1,000, 1,001 different currents, each one a different color, weaving in and out of one another like a liquid tapestry of breathtaking complexity. And If explained that these were the streams of story, that each colored strand represented and contained a single tale. Different parts of the ocean contained different sorts of stories, and as all the stories that had ever been told, and many that were still in the process of being invented, could be found here, the ocean of the streams of story was in fact the biggest library in the universe. And because the stories were held here in fluid form, they retained the ability to change, to become new versions of themselves, to join up with other stories and so become yet other stories. So that unlike a library of books, the ocean of the streams of story was much more than a storeroom of yarns. It was not dead, but alive.
That idea that stories continually flow, feed off one another, that throughout time these stories keep changing slightly, but they're familiar in a way. It's a lovely, lovely image.
Well, I think any of us who, you know, in this game knows that all books in some way come from other books. You know, I mean, obviously they come from other things too. They come from life and experience. But I remember there was a wonderful moment when William Faulkner was accused of plagiarism for As I Lay Dying, that there was some other book which used multiple narrations. He gave this brilliant, only Faulkner could have said this. He said, when I am in the throes of my genius, I take whatever I need from wherever I can find it. and I think, you know, all of us would agree that we, I don't know about the throes of our genius, but we do it too.
This novel mixes realism with fantasy, but it's also rooted in a kind of real-world sadness. Haroon's father, Rashid, is celebrated for his great oral storytelling ability. He has the gift of gab, as you call it. That gift dissolves, though, when his wife, Haroon's mother, leaves him for another man. And this sets Haroon on the journey to restore the sea to health, give his father access again to those stories that he needs to make a living. How powerful a force was storytelling in your own childhood? And did your own father or perhaps your mother have that gift of gab that Haroon so admires?
Well, you know, in different ways, they both did. In fact, the way in which I first heard many of the famous stories of the East, you know, the kind of Arabian Night stories and so on, I heard as my father, in my father's tellings of them as bedtime stories when I was a kid, you know. So he was very good at that, at telling stories to little children as they were going to sleep. You know, my mother was a different kind of storyteller. She was like a world-class gossip. And she knew where all the bodies were buried. You know, she knew all the dirty secrets of everybody. And like a true gossip, couldn't keep them to herself. You know, I remember there was a point at which she said, I'm going to stop telling you this stuff because you put it in your books and I get in trouble.
What a combination, then. The classic storytelling, a little bit of gossip thrown in.
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, I think I got a lot from both of them. Anyways,
some of the imagery in this book I think would look really cool in a feature film. And I'm thinking here especially of when the heroes enter the land of Chup, where shadow creatures are dwelling in a world of perpetual darkness. They can't abide the light. To see in the light, in fact, they use the opposite of flashlights. These are devices that emit beams of darkness instead. And just that imagery there, I wonder if there was ever talk about turning this book into a movie.
Well, we've been trying to, for a long time. I hope it will happen. There's a British film company which has been kind of sitting on the rights rather frustratingly for a while. So I have to say, talking about the dark bulbs, which you mentioned, the switching on the darkness, I was rather flattered to note that it happens in one of the Harry Potter books.
Is that right?
Yeah. She has an object, J.K. Rowling has an object which I can't remember who has, maybe it's even Harry, called a deluminator, which when you switch it on, it switches on the darkness. So I thought, oh, maybe she read my book.
So maybe again, getting back to Faulkner, talking about not stealing, but ideas again.
No, I think you have to be, I think if an idea of yours ends up in Harry Potter, you just have to be flattered.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I'm sure she would be flattered too. One of the characters in the book asks the question, why do stories matter if they aren't even true? How does fiction specifically find a foothold in a world that seems increasingly obsessed with the, quote, reality of things? I'm thinking about things like reality television, memoirs are big, real-world events that often outdo fiction and shocking and captivating audiences. Yeah. Where does fiction fit in these days?
Well, in many ways, the whole book is an attempt to answer that question, really. And it's really trying to say that we are all, you know, human beings, we are storytelling creatures. You know, we're the only species on the planet that does this very weird thing of telling itself stories in order to understand what kind of creature it is. You know, and some of those stories are, of course, true stories, and some of them are like family stories, and some of them are national stories, and some of them are make-believe. You know, and I think it's that mixture, the need to understand ourselves through story, you know, is very central to human beings. You know, I mean, after when a child is born, once the child feels safe and well-fed and warm, etc., very early on, what it wants is a story. Tell me a story, you know, children say. And so it's something very deep-rooted in human beings, the need for story.
Is there a character in this book that you identify with particularly, if so?
Well, I mean, I suppose, you know, the storyteller, Haroon's father, Rashid, certainly my children would recognize that as a lampoon of myself. but um, I fortunately never had the difficulty that Rashid has, which is running out of stories to tell. I mean, so that hasn't happened to me yet. But I thought what I thought was an interesting reversal in the story is that in the story, it's the child's job to save the adult, you know, rather than the other way around. And it's very much kind of Haroon to the rescue, you know. And I thought it was much more enjoyable to do it that way around.
It seemed like you were not afraid to, if that character did identify with you, to lampoon yourself a little bit.
Yeah.
When he loses that gift of gab, he can't say anything but, I think, arc.
Yeah,
arc.
He's just
at one point.
Yes, he's just caught. Nothing comes out of his mouth, you know. And this is also because he comes from a tradition, the character comes from a tradition which is still very much alive in India, not so here, of oral storytelling. You know, that there are still very, very successful oral storytellers who wander around, you know, gathering really quite sizable audiences to tell stories to the audience. And of course, the great thing about the oral tale is that the storyteller knows exactly whether he's holding his audience or not. Because if he doesn't hold them, they get up and walk away. You know, if they don't like it, they throw things. So, so the great oral storytellers are actually wonderful to listen to because they show you how to do that, how to hold an audience, you know, how to keep attention, how to keep interest. And I have in my time sat and listened to quite a few of these guys in India. And so the character of Rashid, in a way, comes more out of that than out of me. It comes out of the oral storytelling tradition.
This book also has, it's got everything from puns and like the plaintemps, fish in the sea, plaintemps. I love that. Flying mechanical birds that communicate telepathically. The sea of stories, of course, we talked about. Shadows that can live independently from the people they're attached to. I have to believe, though, unless I'm reading too much into it, that you are making a serious point, too, in this book about the threat to freedom of expression. There is a moment when Haroon meets Khatam Shud, who's trying to destroy the Sea of Stories. And I'd like you to read an excerpt again, if you would. And this is the exchange between Haroon and Khatam Shud.
Yeah. Khatam Shud is he's known as the cult master. He's the leader of this kind of cult of silence and is the person involved in trying to destroy the Sea of Stories. And he's talking to Haroon here, and he says, "Soon now, soon, the ocean will be dead, cold and dead. When black ice freezes over its surface, my victory will be complete." "But why do you hate stories so much?" Haroon blurted, feeling stunned. "Stories are fun." "The world, however, is not for fun," Khatam Shud replied. "The world is for controlling." "Which world?" Haroon made himself ask. "Your world, my world, all worlds," came the reply. "They're all there to be ruled. And inside every single story, inside every stream in the ocean, there lies a world, a story world, that I cannot rule at all. And that is the reason why."
That's a little chilling. Now, you wrote this book, obviously, decades before the terrible events in France, the murders of those 12 journalists and cartoonists from Charlie Hebdo. Does that exchange you just read, though, illustrate your concerns over events like that and the people that perpetrated
them? Yeah, well, I mean, it was the first book I wrote. Haroon and the Sea of Stories was the first book I wrote after the attack on my work, or after the attack on the Satanic Verses, which was the year before this. So obviously that was something very much in my mind, you know, at the time. And I wanted to approach that subject in a way that, after all, I was primarily writing for my young son, but not only. You know, and I was, as you said earlier, I hoped that adults would find, if you like, another book, you know, another way of reading the book. Children would get children's pleasure, and adults hopefully would get a kind of adult pleasure. And certainly to those adult readers, I was trying to talk about the battle between speech and those who would strangle it, you know, those who would gag it, silence it. And that very much came out of the experience that I'd just gone through, you know, and which now, as you say, sadly, many other people are going through or have gone through.
As you just referred to, you know all too well the lengths that some people will go to in an effort to suppress or seek revenge for creative expression that offends people's beliefs. The fatwa issued against you in 1989 you escaped the violence, but people close to you didn't. I understand that the Japanese translator for some of your books was murdered.
Well, yeah, there were several attacks on publishers and translators and bookstores. There were bookstores that were firebombed. Yes, the Japanese translator of the Satanic Verses, Professor Igarashi, was murdered in his college in Japan when he'd been working late one night. The Norwegian publisher of the book was shot 3 times in the back and miraculously not only survived but made a full recovery. The Italian translator of the book was also attacked and knifed and kicked, and he also fortunately lived. But it was a very dangerous time.
I saw a statement that you issued not long after the attacks in France, and you called religion itself a medieval form of unreason. I'm wondering if it's possible to defend Islam from those who blame it specifically for these kind of deadly attacks while at the same time criticizing religion as a whole.
Well, I mean, I think, look, religions are not monolithic. You know, they're not just one thing. And of course, there's an enormous number of people in the Muslim world who, of whom these criticisms could not be made, you know, and should not be made. But something very dark has happened inside Islam, which has given rise to a body of fanaticism, which actually it's, of course, there's only ever a few psychopaths who go out and kill people, you know, but there's a broader group of people within the Muslim world who, in a way, accept the ideas of jihad. And I think that has a lot of that has to do with the rise of religious schools around the Muslim world, financed by Saudi money, to propagate a very extreme version of Islam, and that I think has had a very harmful effect.
Does religion, no matter which religion I'm talking here, does it do something to suppress humor? And I don't mean to make this sound glib, but it seems to me that one thing all perpetrators of terrorism lack is a sense of humor.
Yes, I mean, I've often said that about the attack on my own work, that it felt like a battle between people who had a sense of humor and people who did not. You know? And I mean, I think it's important to remember that in the 18th century, the time of the French Enlightenment, which was the time when really the modern idea of free expression was developed and eventually became what we all think. And actually, in many ways, the American Constitution came out of that idea, those ideas as well. Well, the battle of the French Enlightenment was not against the state; it was a battle against the church. You know, the church with its inquisitions and anathemas and, you know, excommunications and all these tools that the Catholic Church had to control ideas. The French intellectuals like Voltaire and Rousseau and Montesquieu and Diderot, they saw that what needed to happen was to break the power of the church to tell people what they could think and what they could say. And so the victory of the French Enlightenment was a victory over the church, not over the state. And out of that came the modern idea of free expression. So now you could argue that we're having a similar battle, but, you know, different religion, different church, but same argument.
Within that battle you're talking about now, is this a watershed kind of moment, or is this just something else that's caught up in the news cycle? I mean, do you see a turning point, those millions of people that marched in France?
I think it was very encouraging what happened in France. You know, I mean, I think it was, I mean, for a start, speaking as a person who uses pens and pencils for a living, I thought, what other country would have 4 million people on the street holding up pencils to defend what people who use pencils do for a living? You know, I thought that's, you know, bravo, France, I thought, you know. And also it really was the whole country. You know, it was people on the left, on the right. It was Christians, Muslims, atheists. It was literally the whole of France. And it was a real show of national unity. And I think that's that was a good sign. I mean, let's see what happens now. I mean, that was a moment, you know. We'll see how things work out.
I imagine that when this first happened, a lot of people came to you because of what happened to you and wanted your reaction to that.
Well, you know, I mean, I'm a sort of lifetime non-believer, you know, so religion's not my team. I mean, Christopher Hitchens and I were, I don't know which one of us was more extreme in our beliefs, but I think actually Christopher was always more extreme than anyone else in his beliefs, so it was probably him. so I've always thought that freedom from religion is something to be desired, you know. And we unfortunately, I mean, I think, you know, I mean, I'm a child of the 60s. You know, I was 21 in 1968. And I think if, in that generation, if you had suggested that religion would become such an incredibly powerful political force in the world again, it would have seemed laughable. You know, I mean, really, at that time, that kind of language seemed over. It seemed from the past. You know, it didn't seem to have anything to do with the present or the future. You know, and yet, how wrong we were. Here it is again.
What happened in those intervening decades then?
I don't know. I think what happened is that while we were busy, so to speak, inhaling, kind of the uncool people took over the world.
Those without a sense of humor, perhaps.
Exactly.
Vermont has some rather proud literary connections. Wallace Stegner lived here for many summers. Annie Proulx lived here. Rudyard Kipling wrote much of The Jungle Book while he lived in Vermont. Have you been to Vermont before? And what do you know about this place other than it's really cold in the winter?
Well, I mean, I haven't been here in Burlington before, but I have been in Vermont a number of times. And actually, I actually was taken to see the Kipling House, you know, so I actually have visited there once. And I mean, I've had, you know, the writer John Irving, who's a good friend of mine, lived in Vermont for a long time, and I used to go visit with him, you know. So I've been, yeah, I mean, I'm not unfamiliar with the state. And I gather, I haven't yet tried the local beer, but I gather it's legendary, so I have to probably experiment with that.
We can make some good recommendations to you off air for some places to go. Okay. The craft beer movement in Vermont is a big, big thing right now. How do you feel about Vermont students all reading Haroon and the Sea of Stories? And what do you hope they get out of the experience?
Well, I'm just happy that, you know, it's not a new book. I mean, the book's been, you know, came out in 1990. I mean, it's, you know, it's a quarter of a century ago. The boy for whom it was written is now 35. So I'm, first of all, I'm just happy that another generation has a chance to engage with it. I mean, it's actually been, for me, one of the most pleasure-giving of my books, because I can see why children's book writers so often have, you know, great smiles on their faces, you know, because the kind of response you get from younger readers is so delightful. You know, I mean, I remember getting, actually, I think I just realized it was from Vermont. When the book first came out, I got a letter from a teenage girl, she must have been 13 or something, who said to me, who was from I can't remember where in Vermont, but I'm pretty sure it was from this state, in which she asked me a couple of questions about the book and then rather kind of insistently said, kindly reply to this letter at once, because when I grow up, I intend to be either a writer myself or a world leader.
That's delightful.
I thought answer did
you?
That girl.
And did you?
I did. I said, answer this girl quickly. She's going to be president. You know? So, I do think there's something very pleasurable about, direct about the way in which younger readers engage with the text and the way in which they talk to writers. I mean, I would get these letters saying, we like this bit, we didn't like this bit, here's an idea for a sequel. Maybe next time you could have this character could have a bigger part, etc. You know, so they engage with the book in really very passionately, you know, and that's delightful to the author, of course. And I'm just looking forward to having another round of it.
And may I ask what you're working on next and what we might expect from you next?
Well, I just finished a novel, in fact. I mean, it's coming out, I hope, in the fall. And in a funny way, it's not unrelated to this book because it's not for younger readers. It's in a way, you could. I asked myself, if I were to use those techniques of fable and fantasy out of which this book came, but do it not for children, do it for grown-ups, what would that look like? And this new novel is the answer to that. It's got a rather lengthy title. It's called 2 Years, 8 Months, and 28 Nights. And if you do the math, that's 1,001 nights. But it's not set in olden days. You know, it's set like here now. But it uses a lot of the techniques that are used in Haroon.
We'll certainly look forward to that. Salman Rushdie is a world-renowned and award-winning author. His book, Haroon and the Sea of Stories, is the Humanities Council's pick for Vermont Reads this year. Salman Rushdie, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Oh, thank you. I really enjoyed it.